On Tech News Today, University Eggheads program a robot by sending him to preschool. Google is returning to China with a censored Play Store. And Chrysler drives security experts crazy with its latest hackable Jeep blunder. It's all coming up next on Tech News Today.
This is Twit.
Bandwidth for Tech News Today is provided by CashFly at CacheFly.com.
This is Tech News Today for Friday, September 4th, 2015. This episode is brought to you by Intel. Small business owners can't afford to choose between A or B. If both help your business, you want A and B. With Intel Power 2-in-1s, you get performance and mobility, power and freedom. That's the power of AND. Experience it at smallbusiness.intel.com. And by Blue Apron. Blue Apron will send you all the ingredients to cook fresh, delicious meals with simple step-by-step instructions right to your door. See what's on the menu this week and get your first two meals free by going to blueapron.com/twit. That's blueapron.com/twit. Tech News Today is the show where we talk about the tech news with the journalists who report it. My name is Mike Elgin. Welcome to the show. Our co-anchor today is Mashable senior tech correspondent Christina Warren. Good morning, Christina. How you doing? Good afternoon, I should say.
Yes, good afternoon. Good to be here. Happy weekend Friday, whatever we're calling this.
We're calling it Force Friday, Christina.
You know what? That is the right thing to call it. It is Force Friday. Hopefully the Force was with you and you got your BB-8.
I didn't get one yet for some reason that I just can't explain, but I will have possession of one before the weekend is out, I can assure you. Now, it's an interesting, fun mechanical technology, I think, in addition to the digital stuff that's behind the BB-8. But there was a GIF that, can you throw that up, Jason, about how the BB-8 actually works? And it kind of like illustrates the innards. Do you have the GIF of the, like, it's like a drawing. It looks like a kind of a semi-mechanical drawing of the BB-8. Now, how it works is there are little wheels on the bottom that are weighted. So the wheels are always in the bottom of this thing. And then on the top, there's a sort of arch-shaped thing that follows the inside contour of the ball, and there are magnets there that tell the head where to be on the ball and also which way to be looking. It's brilliant technology. I absolutely love this thing. So, anyway.
It's very cool. Yes, made by Spiro, and they make really cool stuff, and they're the perfect people to make this toy. So it's expensive, but I want one.
I don't think it's that expensive for what it is, really.
I mean, I don't either. No, I think that for what it is, it's actually a good price. It's only $20 more, I think, than the regular Spiro, and it's obviously got a lot more. I mean, it's a lot cooler. I'm just saying for people who might be looking at buying it, if you simply look at it as a toy or a movie, or if it's a movie toy, it's a little expensive. But if it's kind of a cool little gadget, you know, droid sort of thing, I think it's fun.
The fact that it has an automatic mode that'll just go patrolling around your house, make sure you put up like the little doggy gate in case you have stairs, if it's upstairs.
Seriously.
Now, this is a pretty cool Force Friday toy, but also the Millennium Falcon drone is cool, and your own fine organization pointed to where people can get their hands on it for a really good price, and so I'm pretty excited about this one too. Although, it's something that there's so many great drones to choose from. This is unlike the BB-8, which is kind of completely unique. The Millennium Falcon drone is purely for the Star Wars fans, but it seems to fly pretty well, actually.
Yeah, no, I mean, it looks pretty cool. And I have to say, I love the design. It's pretty awesome. I mean, to be able to kind of have a Millennium Falcon drone. I mean, honestly, if you're in the market for a drone, like that's right up there. I mean, I think maybe the only thing that would be as cool would be if you had like an Enterprise, themed drone. But I honestly think the Millennium Falcon is even better.
It certainly is. And here's a pro tip for those of you who like to annoy and disrupt your office mates. Here's what you do. You get a really loud speaker system. You play the theme to Star Wars. You get like 10 of these things and you swarm them into the office and essentially attack your coworkers. Guaranteed levity.
Yes.
I guarantee it. Now, all right. So I wanted to just quickly talk to you about three more things. One of them is the Microsoft event this morning, which we covered live. And this was the most, trying to be charitable, but I'm just not going to. Microsoft is clueless about how to do an IFA keynote. They got on stage and they basically introduced Windows 10, an operating system that has been out there in the public eye for months. And certainly everybody in that audience was using it as they were hearing a demo of it from a guy who was selling it like he was a snake oil salesman, or it was like some kind of ill-conceived infomercial from late night or something like that. It was like a Ginzu knife commercial. and making matters worse, as Jason was obsessing about, is that the camera was on. He was demoing software, which was displayed on a giant screen for the people who were there, and the camera stayed on him. So we never saw his demo. We saw the back of the laptop he was using. We saw his face, but we never saw the thing he was demonstrating. I mean, and they had, Jason counted it, was three cameras in the room, and they didn't use them to show the screen. So that was a complete disaster. And then they went off and they showed some laptops. There was one new thing that was announced yesterday or today or Wednesday. That was cool. It was a liquid-cooled gaming laptop. They also showed a Toshiba laptop. They couldn't say the name of it. That was new. Everything else was old and on the market. It was just ridiculous. Really bad move. 1 week before Apple's announcement, which is going to have all kinds of truly new things that nobody's ever seen before. So this is a disaster for
Microsoft. Not only that, but I mean, we were pre-briefed before IFA, and we've got two reporters there, Lance and Ray. You know, there were, beyond just what Microsoft showed off, there were some new laptops from Asus and Toshiba, as they mentioned, and other companies that they could have mentioned. Things that were actually genuinely new. The fact that it's like, why even bother spending the money to go to IFA if all you're going to do is rehash a product that not only did you have a big launch for, that was a global launch, you know, 2 months ago at this point, but also that you've now shown off in public a bunch of times. You know, it makes no sense. You're dead on it. I mean, at this point, it's like, save your money.
Yeah, exactly. Like, exactly.
Why?
Right. Although, you know, and then when they did the HoloLens announcement, that was really exciting. That was really great stuff and surprising.
I mean, honestly, if you're going to recycle something, recycle HoloLens.
Exactly. Good point. A very good point. Okay, so the next thing I want to just mention briefly, no need to talk about it, it's Google's 17th birthday. It seems like Google is a younger company than that, but they're now the grizzled old age of 17 years old.
It is, Mike, is that we're getting older and we don't want to keep in mind, like, that, you know, when, you know what I mean? It's one of those things where I don't want to admit that I was 15 when Google started. It's one of those things where I feel like I'm closer to 15 than I actually am.
Yeah. And I certainly don't like to say that I was 15 when Google started. I've never said that. This is not even remotely true. And then finally, there was a little nugget buried in a New York Times article that was sort of previewing what Apple might launch. And they actually said that Apple may announce a less expensive gold Apple Watch. What do you think about that idea? Is that a good idea to lower the price?
You know, I think that it depends. I think that if they made it maybe part of like anodized, kind of colored, you know, gold, the same way that they do the iPhones, maybe there was a sport edition available in gold. So it's the same, maybe, you know, I guess finish that you have on the iPhone and the iPad. I think that actually would be a good idea, because then people would have the ability to have the gold color, but obviously you don't have the prestige or the quality or anything of the gold Apple Watch. So, I mean, I don't think that would be a bad idea. I think that for the sport model, especially, it might add a little bit of variety. I assume that the sport is the most popular model being sold right now. I'm not sure, you know, until they let us know one way or another. I have the stainless steel. I really like that. But I think that if they did an anodized kind of aluminum in the gold, you know, color, that would do really well.
Especially in China.
Yes.
More news coming right up. First, let's talk about Intel. Of course, Microsoft didn't announce anything of its own today at its big event in Berlin, but they did show off a whole bunch of devices, and some of them were extremely powerful devices that you can buy right now. And the best of them were powered by Intel's 2-in-1 technology. 2-in-1 technology, of course, enables companies to build fantastic devices that are tablets 1 minute and laptops the next. And when they're tablets, they're great tablets. And when they're laptops, they're great laptops. They're not like a tablet that you just slap a keyboard on or a laptop that can't be used as a tablet. These are fantastic. And for small businesses, this is usually the perfect solution, because you don't have to compromise. You don't have to make that choice. You don't have to predict what you're going to need in a year. You can buy Intel-powered 2-in-1-based devices and get fantastic wireless performance, fantastic processing performance, fantastic battery life. You can have it all by going to smallbusiness.intel.com. And you can follow Intel Small Business Account on Twitter as well. Just go to Intel Small Biz on Twitter. Experience the power of and. Visit smallbusiness.intel.com and find out how Intel-powered 2-in-1s can improve your small business. That's smallbusiness.intel.com. And we thank Intel for their support of Tech News Today. All right, well, let's jump into the regular news. The U.S. Department of Justice yesterday tightened the rules for some types of cell phone tracking. Federal agencies will now need a warrant before they can track phones using cell site simulators or IMSI catchers or stingrays or dirt boxes. Julia Edwards is a reporter for Reuters and joins us now to talk about it. Welcome to the show, Julia.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Thanks for coming on. How does law enforcement use cell site simulators to track suspects? How does this process work in terms of where they are when they're doing it, what it is they're trying to achieve? How does it work?
So some people may better know these devices by their name stingrays, and they're used by law enforcement through all levels. It could be your local police department to the FBI, and they're used to basically work like a cell phone tower. As we know, if you ever heard the podcast Serial, cell towers are able to identify the location that a call is being made to track down a phone. And that can be really useful for law enforcement, especially if they're trying to find a fugitive, someone who may have kidnapped a child. All these reasons are perfectly legitimate reasons for law enforcement to use these devices. But they can also pick up information from bystanders. So, for example, if you're using your phone next to someone who's being tracked by law enforcement, your information gets sent back too. But what's important to know here is this isn't information like who you're calling or data that you're sending or receiving at all. It's not what we think of when we're thinking of what Snowden revealed that the NSA was collecting. This is simply location, and it's used to pin down the location of someone that law enforcement is looking for.
Speaking of location, where are you right now?
I'm in the White House.
Wow.
This is, someone once said if Donald Trump became president, he would use this area if he kept the press as pets. We are actually very confined.
You are literally in Barack Obama's basement right now.
Yeah, I was just in the Oval Office about an hour ago. So this is as glamorous as it gets right here with all these wires behind me.
I've always wanted to say this. Oh, I was in the Oval Office a half an hour ago and chatting to Barry, and it was a really nice time. Good times.
All right. Well, first of all, go ahead.
So I covered the Justice Department and the White House. I'm kind of wearing two hats these days, which is how I wrote the cell site simulator story, as well as covered the visit of the Saudi king today. It's been a busy week.
That's exciting. We can assume that there are stingrays in the building that you're in right now, I assume. But maybe. Or at least nearby. But what I want to know is how widespread is the use of these sorts of things? Like how frequent? I mean, you said that it's used by all, levels of different agencies at all levels. But how widespread is this usage, would you say?
So it's hard to track. The ACLU, who, as you know, are privacy advocates, have said that at least 53 agencies across 21 states and Washington, D.C. are using these devices. But a lot of agencies don't have to report what equipment they purchase. So some of them could shroud the fact that they have purchased these cell site simulators in secrecy. But we do know that they're used by the FBI, by U.S. Marshals, and by the DEA, the Drug Enforcement Administration, to track the people that they're looking for. But it's really hard to get a sense of how long these have been used and to what extent. I do know yesterday we sat down with the Deputy Attorney General, Sally Yates, and she was a U.S. prosecutor for a long time. She was in Georgia, and she knows as a prosecutor that for some time these devices have been used, and it's actually really long past the time that the Justice Department should put out a policy like this in the first place.
You are an awesome name dropper. you mentioned that they can pick up the locations of innocent bystanders. Is there anything in the Justice Department rules that protects random people who happen to be wandering around from having their locations tracked from agencies?
There is, and I'll let you decide whether or not this goes far enough. But the rules say that any person's information that is picked up that is deemed not to be the person targeted, in other words, the person that a law enforcement agency would be trying to track their location, all that information needs to be deleted within 30 days. And then also, if they know for a fact that they picked up someone's information that is not part of the search, then they need to delete that within a day. So technically, this should make people feel a little more comfortable about their information being picked up. But again, it's really important to keep in mind that this does not go anywhere past Department of Justice agency. So your local police could still be tracking other people and picking up your information and keeping it as long as they want.
Is there any way that we can kind of credit, you said that this information isn't really kind of related to what Snowden revealed, but could we credit him at all in his revelations with the fact that that these policies are now in place?
Absolutely. I think all of this is part of a larger conversation about the balance between securing Americans and the job that law enforcement has in doing that, and then also making sure that our constitutional rights are protected and that we have the right to privacy. And these conversations really spurred and caught fire around the Snowden revelations. And they came up again this year when deciding whether or not to give the NSA the same authorities to collect information on our telephone data. And it's kind of this constant checkpoint that we're seeing throughout the year to see how far police should be going. And it's reining in. You know, it has now been over a decade since September 11th, when a lot of these agencies were given a carte blanche to on oversight, and they could pick up any information they wanted. And coming off of that, people are now starting to think, okay, so where should these surveillance capabilities be limited?
And this, speaking of 9/11 and the aftermath, this does not apply, does it, to the Department of Homeland Security, nor does it apply to the CIA or the NSA, does it?
That's exactly right. One thing Deputy Attorney General Yates said yesterday, though, is that the Department of Homeland Security is looking at a similar proposal. So we could see Border Patrol, TSA, the Secret Service trying to adopt a similar policy. But that doesn't always happen. DOJ does not have any jurisdiction over them, and they've implemented policies this year that DHS hasn't taken a part of.
Before we let you go, I'm curious, does the president still carry a BlackBerry?
You know, he used one for a really long time. We hardly ever see him bring anything out. We've been looking out to see if he has an Apple Watch. Haven't seen that yet. I really want to make sure I know if I'm telling you for sure if he switched to an iPhone. But I know that all of his staff still communicating with press through BlackBerries, and they all still carry theirs. I think it has something to do with the security software they have on it.
They should call them BarackBerries. That's just me. Julia Edwards is at Reuters.com, of course, and on Twitter at JUJ Edwards. Thank you so much for joining us today, Julia.
Thank you.
All right, bye-bye. With rumors swirling about Apple TV support for gaming to be announced Wednesday, Apple has suddenly launched a new game-centric Twitter feed. Brian Fitzgerald is the deputy editor for WSJD and joins us now. Welcome to the show, Brian.
Hi, how are you?
I'm doing great, thank you. Thanks for coming on the show. Now, Apple directs followers on their new Twitter account to, quote, embrace the future of gaming, unquote. When I think of the future of gaming, I'm thinking about augmented reality. I'm thinking about maybe the high-end Xbox or PlayStation games currently under development. The past of gaming is much more likely from Apple, isn't it? I mean, they're already referring to games in the form of examples like Angry Birds, Clash of Clans, mm-hmm. Monument Valley. All of these are yesterday's games.
Right.
Do you think there's actually going to be anything innovative about their upcoming game platform, if you will?
Well, you know, one, I should say it's hard to know, right? So Apple hasn't, despite all the buzz and rumors, Apple hasn't said the products that they're going to talk about. They haven't confirmed that they're even going to show an Apple TV, let alone that it's going to have any features related to gaming. That said, that's like the disclaimer. That said, based on all the buzz, what we're hearing, what we've been reading, I don't see anything terribly innovative about putting app-like games on a streaming box that connects to, you know, a monitor or a TV or whatnot. That kind of stuff is already available, and I haven't seen any numbers that suggest that it's widely successful or there's incredible demand to play in Angry Birds on a television.
No, I mean, I think you make a great point, Brian. I think you make a great point. You know, there's obviously this sort of thing has been around for a while. I would kind of maybe, I guess, bring up the question just because it's been done. I think you would agree it hasn't been done successfully. So there's probably still potential if there is indeed demand for kind of the ability to take the casual games that you enjoy on your phone or your iPad and put it on a bigger screen. If that was done well and if it had widespread support, it could be successful. But what else are you hearing about the game related announcements, you know, when it comes to the Apple TV and when it comes to Wednesday's event?
Well, so quickly, just to make a point on what you just said, you know, the one thing I think about when I think of games for for mobile devices is that they've been incredibly social games, and they've been time waster type of games. Some of them are very rich and robust that can rival consoles, but a lot of them are the kind of games you play when you're on the bus or you're in between some things. That's different than the sort of dedicated, I want to play a game right now, I'm going to sit in front of my television. And that's where my little bit of skepticism comes in, and I think Apple would need to sort of do something that leapfrogs above what has been available already. What we've been, to answer your question, Christina, a good one, what we've been hearing and seeing, and again, I don't have any exclusive knowledge to report, is that the Apple TV is going to have a remote control. Its remote will have some touch sensors, some motion controllers, and this is what outfits like 9to5 Mac and BuzzFeed have been reporting. And those would be the kinds of features in the control in the remote for the Apple TV that would lend itself to be a controller.
Are you concerned about this controller? I mean, it sounds ridiculous to be concerned about a controller or a remote control, but I am. I mean, the current Apple TV controller, which of course is not up to the task of dealing with games or any of the rest, is nevertheless a marvel of search, right? Is nevertheless a marvel of simplicity. It's a little aluminum thing. It has almost no controls on it at all.
It gets lost everywhere.
Fits perfectly in between those cushions. But the one that's being described by some of the blogs out there has motion, sensors, the same ones that are in the iPhone 6, I believe. It has a touchpad. It has a microphone, so you talk into it. There's like five ways to get at it. It doesn't sound Apple-y to me at all.
It sounds
a lot like the device that you have been carrying in your pocket for a long time. So right. I think to some respects, it's going to be very familiar to people. I know with my own Apple TV, I often will just use my phone rather than try to find, like you said, My Apple remote is generally under the couch or in a cushion, so right. I will often just use my phone because it's available and easy and certainly better for search. So if the Apple TV, the new remote, has some of the features of your phone, I actually think it could be quite comfortable, and I think it would be necessary if there was going to be any kind of gaming platform as part of the new hardware.
Or frankly, I mean, I would just say, I mean, I love the simplicity of the Apple remote, but I'm with you. I use mine a lot, on either my phone, my iPad, or even my watch now. At this point, it's almost too simple because, you can go forward, back, and whatnot. But if you're trying to add new features, especially if they're talking about getting into games, it's going to have to be a little more complex. I agree with you completely.
Totally. What I'm curious about, the question in my mind is cost. So yeah. if the new Apple TV is going to be in the $150 range, that's what I've been seeing, maybe $199. Yes. I doubt it'll be $99. That would be crazy talk. What kind of controller, what kind of energy are you going to have there? Because these are, motion controller and touch, these are somewhat sophisticated technologies. And so I'm very curious as to how Apple is marrying the cost of the new hardware with the feature set of the box and the remote.
Brian, you actually suggest an interesting strategy, which actually sounds to me to be more likely than the one I've been thinking of, which is just that they ship with this remote. Everybody's supposed to use a remote, which is that they come out with an app and you're supposed to use the Apple TV with your phone, with your iPhone. And oh, by the way, for you goobers who don't have an iPhone, we also have this remote.
Apple, among, all companies, has the greatest ability to do that kind of hardware tie-in. I have to imagine anybody who has an Apple TV or who wants an Apple TV has an iPhone. And so, the company could make a very strong case that you already have the best game controller in your pocket, and that's what you're going to use.
Yeah, I think that makes a lot of sense. Brian Fitzgerald is at WSJ.com and on Twitter at BryFitz. Thank you. Bry is spelled B-R-Y.
Yes.
Fitz is F-I-T-Z. Brian, thank you.
Only my childhood friends.
Yeah. Thank you for joining us today on Tech News Today.
Thank you both.
All right. Researchers at the University of California at Berkeley are programming a robot the old-fashioned way. They're sending it to preschool, according to a long-form piece on Bloomberg by Neural Network reporter Jack Clark. Jack, welcome to the show.
Hi there. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for coming on. And you claim on Twitter to be the world's only neural network reporter, I believe.
It's a sufficiently obscure subject. There's not a huge amount of competition yet.
Well, congratulations on that. And I'm the world's only lovable tech journalist, so I have something in common. So what did you mean when you wrote that this Berkeley robot, whose name is Brett, by the way, is attending preschool? What does that mean?
It means that the robot is being taught to learn about the world and solve problems in a way more analogous to how children, very young children, learn about objects and learn to solve tasks than a traditional computer. And the upshot of that is that today's industrial robots require a lot of heavy engineering, a lot of custom programming of sort of their pipelines for what they need to do and when they need to do it. This robot doesn't have that. Instead, it has what's called a neural network, a very, very large scale sort of mass of digital neurons, which help it adjust its behaviors and learn over time in the same way that a child will learn to put, you know, stack Lego blocks on top of one another and quickly master it.
All right. So this is totally fascinating, but I have to go back to one of the first things you said. So the robot's name is Brett, but tell us what Brett stands for, because I think this is amazing.
It stands for the Berkeley Robot for the Elimination of Tedious Tasks. And Brett has come a long way. I believe in 2011, they demonstrated Brett being able to fold towels in a sort of scut work that no one enjoys to do. They got Brett to be able to do it. But all of the videos sped it up by 50 times because Brett was moving incredibly slowly. It was very tedious. It was very frustrating. And so in sort of 4 years, we've gone from this robot being able to fold towels incredibly slowly to being able to move with human speed to solve relatively complex problems.
Now, one could imagine that this is a leading edge way to program AI in the future, that all the robots will go through this whole K-12 process or something. But in fact, if you could in fact teach a robot to do things by learning and experiencing, you really could do something that humans can't do, which is that once you have a robot that's, you know, got a PhD, you can just copy that 10,000 times.
That is already happening. FANUC, the industrial robot giant from Japan, which makes the bright yellow iconic industrial robots you see in car factories, That's partnered with a startup here in the Valley called Preferred Networks to add AI to its robots. And it said in the announcement, which was 2 weeks ago, that it will use the cloud to let the robots update their robot brothers and sisters on new behaviors and let the robots teach each other things. Which is less terrifying than it sounds.
But that's still amazing. I love that. You had mentioned in your piece, you know, the Brett's human-like AI network, it resulted in some surprises. Can you talk about some of those?
Yeah. So over the summer, the researchers added memory to the robot. Memory is a subset of AI which is being worked on by Google and Facebook and others right now, and it's a way to let machines do long-term reasoning and pattern recognition. So they added this to the robot and they thought, great, this will let it solve more complex tasks. Like we can ask it to put an object like a phone in one of two containers and it will be able to remember which container we've asked it to put it in. Now, when they tested it, they found that it wasn't using the new memory component at all. And so they did some experiments and they discovered that when they asked it to, say, put an object in one of two areas, it was instead inclining its hand very slightly in one direction, then would look at its body and use that to work out where to go. So it was doing what people do, which is we count on our fingers instead of having to actually remember something. We use our body to remember. And it had improvised this solution. This was not programmed by the researchers and they didn't expect to find this behavior. So that demonstrates the kind of incredible adaptability and emergence that comes out of using modern AI techniques.
And I believe that was the single most astonishing fact in your article, the fact that it's invented something nobody saw coming as a sort of shortcut that wasn't programmed. And that sort of, you know, scale that up a bazillion times and you've got something really amazing. This is amazing already, but still, it's just incredible. Now, we are all familiar, of course, with the HAL 9000 robot in 2001, A Space Odyssey. HAL stands for heuristic algorithm. And the reason they called it that is because heuristic means self-teaching or learning through experience. And the reason they called it that is that's how they trained HAL in the movie. So, and in the book that came out with it. And in fact, when they unplug HAL, HAL sort of reverts to that preschool programming and starts singing a song learned in HAL Robot Preschool. Let's take a listen to this. And this is, of course, from HAL. This is from 2001, A Space
Odyssey. Good afternoon, gentlemen. I am a HAL 9000 computer. I became operational at the HAL plant in Urbana, Illinois, on the 12th of January, 1992. My instructor was Mr. Langley, and he taught me to sing a song. If you'd like to hear it, I can sing it for you.
One of the greatest scenes in the history of cinema.
Sing it for me.
It's called Daisy. 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 Give me your answer, do. I'm half crazy. All for the love of you.
So, Jack, this is what we're dealing with here, isn't it?
Yeah, but I mean, there's a couple of aspects which they got slightly wrong, you know, because it's 50 years ago. One of them is that you're removing kind of modules and the computer's becoming noticeably less intelligent and less capable. The way that current neural networks work and how we think we're going to build very complex things is you get a field of millions upon millions of neurons which are arranged in a hierarchy, but it's not like there's specific sections that you can knock out in order and see a degradation of behavior. It's more that the entity comes from the whole, and that's somewhat like people. You know, we know that you can turn off certain bits of people's brains, and you'll sometimes see degradation of behavior, but more often than not you'll see almost no effect for a very long time, because we naturally improvise around absences, and then suddenly you'll have something very, very bad happening. So that was kind of interesting to me. But the broad elements of it, of, you know, heuristics and self-learning, that's true. And that's going to be the way that we get machines that bootstrap themselves into higher order sort of consciousness.
And of course, there's a moral element to this, which is that we learned in later books that the reason that HAL freaked out and started killing off the crew was because he was told to conceal information, which was counter to his primary mission of not concealing information from the crew. So he had conflicting instructions and, of course, turned into a homicidal maniac. So it's coming. Jack Clark is at Bloomberg.com and on Twitter at Mapping Babble. Jack, thank you so much for coming on Tech News Today. Fascinating article.
Thanks very much.
All right, thank you. An exclusive on The Information says Google is planning to return to China. If you recall, Google had a falling out with the Chinese government in 2010 after they learned that China hacked Google and infiltrated Gmail to hunt down pro-democracy activists. Since then, Google hasn't had an official presence in China. The Information report says Google is planning to open an official Chinese Google Play Store, and to make that happen is willing to censor the store on behalf of the Chinese government. Christina Warren, your thoughts?
I mean, well, obviously they need to do this, right? When they left China 5 years ago, it was a little bit of a different situation. Mobile hadn't taken off the way that it has now. It certainly hadn't exploded in China the way that it has. Android wasn't anything close to what it is right now. They could take kind of, I guess, the moral stance that they took and arguably maybe ethical stance to leave. But they need to have a presence there, especially because Android is so huge in China, but in mainland China, you know, Google Play doesn't exist. So you've got all of these third-party app stores where it's frankly, you know, not something that they're able to make any money on or do anything with. And it's a problem for them because you've got all these other manufacturers who are basically profiting off of Android, and Google's not able to have any part of that pie at all. So if they don't want to either sit back to the people, you know, the Xiaomis of the world, and the other companies that are building up these app stores and these really big and frankly, you know, profitable ecosystems, or they don't want to, you know, cede the entire market to Apple as well, you know, the company that does have kind of direct control, then they need to do this. So I think it makes sense. But it is interesting that, you know, in 5 years' time, I mean, I think you could argue that Google's kind of flinching a little bit. You know, the fact that they are going to be agreeing to censor content in the store to meet the Chinese government's needs. Obviously, that's something they do for their search products in other areas. But considering their history with China, I mean, I think this just is recognition of how important China is as a market to them going forward and for them in the future.
Yeah, absolutely. And of course, I think that the primary reason that Android exists as a Google product is to make sure that the world is safe for Google software and services.
Right.
And China threatens that because, in fact, like you say, so many of the upstarts, the handset vendors, are Chinese. And you can imagine them all getting together and saying, you know what, why are we using Android? Why don't we invent our own Android? Why don't we have our own? And that would be a huge problem for Google.
No, it definitely is. I mean, Cyanogen is one of those companies that's kind of doing that, you know, or Xiaomi would really probably have kind of the best thing. If you look at what they do with you know, their what they call their MIUI, it's not that far removed to say we could have a really good fork where we're taking some of the changes you make and some of the maybe the security things, but we're going to tweak this and basically make it our own thing, rip out every part of the Google aspect and not make it, you know, amenable to your services, your browser, your tools, your other stuff, and take all the, you know, the millions, the billions of dollars, frankly, that Google has invested in it and just, you know, do our own thing. And they can't afford to let that happen. Not in China, not with that market. Especially since, you know, we just see the rise of the Chinese smartphone makers going so broad. And the last thing they want is for the idea of the non-Google Play store to spread beyond China. Yeah. You know, they really need to kind of nip that in the bud. And I think the best way to do that is to actually make, you know, Google a brand that the Chinese understand and recognize again.
Well, and to have such a lead in the apps and the buy-in that it's too late for a new entrance to get in there. So, hopefully this will help them do that. Although I don't like it, but still, what do I?
Yeah, you know, I don't like it either. But I mean, they're kind of between a rock and a hard place, right? Like, what are they going to do? Yeah. You either have to give up China, or you have to kind of play ball is kind of what they've decided. I think at one point they thought that they were in a strong enough position that China would just kind of have to capitulate to their needs. That's not the case.
Yeah. Richard Nixon came to the same conclusion in 1972. Google updated its Chrome browser to be faster and lighter. Thank goodness. The new Chrome 45 version now renders the most recently used tabs first, which means that those are the ones you're probably going to go to, and therefore, while the others load, you're not affected. The browser also does memory management when you take a break or aren't using heavy processes, and these and other improvements complement the other big feature we reported earlier this week, which is that Chrome now pauses Flash ads by default. So this is
great. This is great. Well, it's interesting because one of our best performing stories kind of from a utility perspective that we ran a couple months ago was about a Chrome extension called the Great Suspender, which basically does a lot of what now Chrome's going to be doing built in. And so there have been extensions like the Great Suspender, like OneTab, other kind of management plugins. The fact that those extensions have had to exist at all is a kind of sad and shows that Chrome, which was saving us from the bloat that was Firefox and Internet Explorer, has now become bloated and kind of a little ridiculous itself. But the good news is that at least Google, unlike, you know, Firefox, it took Mozilla much longer and Microsoft too, for that matter, is recognizing these things and is actively trying to make the product better.
Absolutely. And you mentioned the Great Suspender. That's a Chrome plugin that takes the tabs after a user determined amount of time and puts them to sleep so they stop using memory. And OneTab is a Chrome plugin that takes all of your tabs and turns them into links on a single tab so that they're not gobbling up all that memory. And like you said, this is just an example of how the world is trying to deal with the fact that Chrome has been a bloated pig and needs some kind of help. And finally, it's coming to us from Google itself.
Yes.
Well, in mergers and acquisitions news, BlackBerry has good technology. And what I mean by that is that BlackBerry has acquired a company called Good Technology. The company is a former competitor in the enterprise mobile device management space, and BlackBerry bought it for $425 million in cash. Good is best known for its suite of Android device management software. And I think this makes a lot of sense for them. It knocks off a competitor and brings in good Android brand power.
Right when they need it. What's funny is that I think it was 2006, I believe, Motorola bought Good. And back then, the idea was what Good provided was it basically did push email, very similar to what BlackBerry did and was well known for. And so Motorola bought them, and the idea was that they would sell it to other OEMs, mostly on Symbian and maybe some other platforms, and create kind of a push email solution. Then Microsoft opened up Exchange, and everybody just started using Exchange, you know, as kind of the push solution. And Motorola ended up, you know, spinning Good out, and it became independent again. And then it got into the MDM system, although it also does, a lot of people have like good versions for certain documents. There's certain apps on both iOS and Android that are kind of within their containerization strategy. So it's funny too, earlier, maybe it was this year, Good and BlackBerry got into some sort of argument and they played out in the press. BlackBerry's CEO, John Chen, is very quick to call people out if he feels slighted about certain things in the enterprise. And so they're spending $500 million on them, which for a company that is not making a lot of money, doesn't have a huge cash position, this is a big acquisition. But what it effectively does is doubles their market share in the MDM space, which puts them, you know, within striking distance of AirWatch, which is owned by VMware. And so, I mean, that's good, pun intended.
And I thank you for that. You make the bad pun, so I don't have to. And I appreciate that, Christina. Now, I've got a little bit of breaking news from Amazon. It's a small item, but I think it's significant to a certain extent. Amazon is now saying that its Echo will support shared calendars. So if you're sharing a calendar with other family members, Echo can now deal with that and read things off your calendar to know what's going on in your life. So that is an interesting development, I think. Big Echo fan here. Well, in the insecurity department, we told you 6 weeks ago about two researchers who hacked a 2014 Jeep Cherokee for a Wired article. The researchers were subsequently poached by Uber for some reason. Now we're hearing that Jeep maker Chrysler is getting hammered on social media for mailing a million USB thumb drives containing a patch to those Jeep owners via snail mail. Chrysler's being exposed in all this as being totally clueless about security best practices, including the universally agreed upon advice to everyone with a computer to never insert a USB drive that was sent to you by mail. Expect hackers to start mailing USB drives to Jeep owners any minute now.
Yeah, no, I mean, I kind of feel for them a little bit in this case, because you can't expect people to, you know, it would be a lot harder for them to create a firmware builder tool and to expect someone to have their own USB stick and run it and update their car that way, right? That's going to be a more technically advanced thing than someone would be able to do. It's also not necessarily convenient for everyone to go to their dealer and pick up one of these things. But exactly, like getting USB things in the mail is not a great thing, especially when the whole purpose of this is to prevent someone from hacking your car. This whole thing just points out again, as we've talked about time and time again over this thing, it's like enable over the air updates. You know, if you're going to be doing the connected car thing, you've got to go the Tesla way of being able to do over the air updates, because this is ridiculous.
That's absolutely true. You got it exactly right. Well, we got some more news coming right up. But first, let's talk about our other sponsor today, Blue Apron. Let's look at the big picture here. Back in the 19th century, in the first half of the 20th century, futurists used to predict that we would be able to move beyond food and we could have food in pill form. All right. And the advantage of that was that you could not waste all that time on the drudgery of eating, of preparing food, of doing the dishes. You could dispense with all that and spend more time in your flying car. That was the vision for a long, long time on science fiction and futurists and so on. Well, gosh, it turns out that, you know what? Food is a joy. People love food. And we got a much better future than horrible food pills. We got a future in which technology is being used to deliver things like Blue Apron can deliver, which is healthy, fresh ingredients that you prepare yourself. They've got great technology behind the scenes with their sourcing of seasonal ingredients. They have great technology in terms of their iOS app, which enables you to get all kinds of data information about cooking. Their website is phenomenal. You can see every recipe they've ever produced with all the step-by-step ingredients. You can check them out on your own, even if you're not a Blue Apron customer. But once you see what they're doing, you're really going to want to be a Blue Apron customer. And we'll tell you how to get two free meals in just a sec. It's very affordable, $10 per meal, more or less. It takes about 30 minutes to prepare each meal for two. And each balanced meal is 500 to 700 calories per serving. And it's just a great way to learn how to cook. It's a great way for you to introduce all kinds of really interesting foods into your life that are very accessible, very crowd-pleasing. You know, so if you don't like some, you know, certain types of very strange, exotic foods, you know, because your tastes have been developed with a kind of Western palate, you don't have to worry about that because their selection is always fantastic, no matter how exotic the dish, no matter how exotic the ingredients. And of course, they will supply those ingredients, things you might not be able to get in your local store. It's such a great way to apply technology to the real problem of food, which is that food didn't used to be good enough. We didn't used to have enough of variety. We didn't used to have enough seasonal ingredients. We didn't used to have all these. Blue Apron is solving those problems using technology and great, brilliant people who, this is the dinner I made two nights ago. That they see the instructions there, the step-by-step instructions. And I added that loaf of bread there. That was not part of the thing. But this was a great pair of steaks, and I really enjoyed it. My wife enjoyed it, and I did it all myself in half an hour. It's just so great. You have to try Blue Apron because it's a better way to cook. Check out this week's menu and get your first two meals free by going to blueapron.com/twit. That's right. Two meals free just for going to blueapron.com/twit. And we thank Blue Apron for their support of Tech News Today. And that's the dish I made. I made that. I did that. Unbelievable. So good. Well, I got some big numbers for you. 900 million. That's how many users Facebook's WhatsApp now has, according to a post by WhatsApp chief Jan Koum. After Koum posted it, by the way, Facebook CEO Mark Zuckerberg posted a picture in the comments section of Koum posting it. And if you scroll down, you'll see that picture. There's the post, and there's the picture taken by Mark Zuckerberg of him going, is this what I should say? You know what? Doesn't matter what you say. You got 900 million users.
Yep.
Wow. Unbelievable. That is huge. Well, we got another big number for you. 44 million. That's how many Americans downloaded the Apple Music app in its first month, according to Comscore. Now, Christina Warren, this doesn't say anything about usage or, you know, who's in planning to upgrade or any of that stuff. It's just downloaded apps. This is they're coming in right behind the Twitter app.
So it's actually 37 million. We got confirmation from Comscore on that.
Great.
Yes. So it's actually 37 million. 44 million would assume that the 191 million figure that they said was apparently, however they do it, whatever the percentage is it's. If you count in the other platforms other than iOS and Android. Anyway, it's 37 million. What they're also doing is they're not counting it really any differently than how they counted the iTunes app in the past. So if you look at it, usage actually dropped a tiny bit from June when it was just iTunes. But it does show that that basically everybody is upgraded to Apple Music, at least. So.
Well, there it is. And of course, we're going to get a lot more information about Apple Music, I hope, on Wednesday with big announcement. Yep. There's going to be lots of stuff. We're expecting new phones, new iPads, new Apple TV, and new, apparently, a cheaper gold Apple Watch, maybe.
Yeah, maybe.
And so it's going to be quite...
maybe an iPad?
Maybe, yeah. Maybe the iPad Pro. That's what we're hearing. So I'm really excited about that. And it should have a stylus as well. So that Apple with a stylus. Haven't seen that since the Newton.
I'm still saying no on the stylus. I'm still saying that's not happening.
yeah. We'll see how they do it. Well, our TNT fan of the day is Milton Sandino of San Francisco, California, who posted this picture on Google+. Milton's girlfriend brought him to the Brick House this week for his birthday, and he watched later and took this picture. So that's a great shot. And that's, of course, one of our ceiling cams. Show us how you watch or listen to TNT. Just record a video or take a picture of yourself, your setup, or your Brick House and post it on Instagram, Google+, Twitter, or Facebook using the hashtag HowIWatchTNT so we can find it. Christina Warren, what are you working on nowadays, and what are you doing this weekend?
Okay, so this weekend my in-laws are in town, so we're going around New York with them, showing them the city. They're in the financial district, and they're going to a Yankees game tonight. We're taking them to Brooklyn tomorrow, so that'll be a lot of fun. I'm writing up kind of a what to expect for the Apple event post that will be up this weekend. And I'm just generally packing and getting ready for everything Apple for next week, because that's going to be the big news. And then I'm immediately going from Apple to XOXO in Portland. So I will not be your co-host next week, because I will be in Portland.
XOXO is a women in technology conference?
No, that's kind of part of it, but it's really for everybody. So it's kind of like a combination, like tech, art, film, gaming, visual festival. It's like what South by Southwest was like 10 years ago. It's a really good time, and just a lot of really cool kind of eclectic people kind of gathering together. And there's great speakers, and there's also lots of evening events, and it's just really cool. I went last year and I had a blast, and so I'm happy to go this year too.
Sounds like a lot of fun. Christina Warren, thank you so much, and we'll see you time after next.
Week after next.
All right. Thank you so much. Bye bye. Let us know what's on your mind. Send email to tnt@twit.tv or call 260-TNT-SHOW. That's 260-868-7469. You can subscribe to Tech News Today on your podcast app, or you can choose another way to subscribe at tnt@twit.tv. You can also, that's the email address. It's twit.tv/TNT. You can also watch us live every weekday at 10 a.m. Pacific, 1700 UTC at twit.tv/live. And you can subscribe to our subreddit at technewstoday.reddit.com. You can follow me at elgin.com. Don't miss our other tech news show, Tech News Tonight, at 4 p.m. Pacific every single weeknight. Padre is hosting tonight. And that, ladies and gentlemen, is the Tech News Today. This show is produced by Jason Cleanthes and edited by Tony Wang. My name is Mike Elgin. Thanks for tuning in. Now, Monday is the Labor Day holiday here in the United States, so you'll see us back here on Tuesday, and we'll see you then. Bye-bye.